welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, September 22nd, 2023. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, the theme was Off the Hill, Summer of Fire. What's Ottawa got to do with it? In this panel, our guests discuss the social and environmental impact the wildfires had on Canada this summer, how Canadians can get involved with climate justice, and how we can hold the federal government accountable for climate solutions. Our panel included MP Leah Gazan, Clayton Thomas Mueller, Chuka Ejekam, Diana Yoon, and Carl Nirenberg, hosted by Robin Brown and Nick Seabrook. Here is a clip of that panel. Take a listen.
To begin our conversation today, Carl, let's start with you. The House of Commons is back in session. How will Pierre Poilievre's, the Conservative leader's, momentum after the recent Conservative convention affect the government's policy on issues like climate change?
Well, I think Poilievre himself will never talk about climate change directly. He'll only complain about measures taken to mitigate climate change or to slow down climate change or to eventually pretend, we hope, stop climate change. So the extent to which the leader of the opposition will always be asking about other things or framing climate change in a negative way by saying, when are you going to axe the tax? The carbon tax is raising the rate of inflation. The carbon tax is making food unaffordable for people. The carbon tax is driving people into poverty. The carbon tax is responsible for every bad thing that's happening in Canada. It will force the government to somehow craft its message without always sounding all the defensive, without accepting the premises of what Poilievre has to say. So I think it is a problem. I think what is tragic here, I mean, for the longest time after Poilievre became leader of the Conservative Party, the kind of mainstream commentators, people like my friend Chantal Hébert, said it's his Achilles heel, that he's completely negative on climate change. Not only does he not have a policy, but he's borderline denier. All he says is do nothing about it, and that's going to hurt him. But there's a certain point that scares me a lot, that the public in Canada and everywhere else is just kind of quietly grown weary of this, regardless of the consequences, such as the wildfires and everything else that we're experiencing it. And they are sort of, you know, starting to look inward and starting to worry about, am I comfortable today? Am I feeling okay? Will I feel okay tomorrow? And starting to feel a little bit like, oh, we don't want anybody to keep preaching to us how we have to be virtuous and worry about climate change. And a bit the ideology that we're only a little country of 40 million people. Our contribution to climate change is pretty small, although it's way out of proportion to our population. In fact, we each individual, contribute like 10, 30, 40 times more than each individual in an African country, say, or in most countries in Asia. Nonetheless, I think it is going to be a problem, and I'm interested to hear what others have to say about how we can and how they can fight back against this change in rhetoric and this shift in attention.
All right. Thank you, Carl. And I'm going to go to Diana next. And Diana, in the face of wildfires this summer, Canadians have been rising up to demand real climate solutions from the federal government. How can people power like this enact change in Parliament?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. So absolutely, people power is the only way that we enact change against injustice and climate inaction. You know, when you see the devastating impact of wildfires, or even if you experience smoke in cities and communities, that feel really far away from the wildfires. I know many folks felt anxiety, hopelessness, and feel powerless. It's like, what do we do? But I don't believe in, fear-mongering, climate doomism. Like, we have to keep fighting and advocating for governments to step up. And I think to enact this change, it's important so that we take care of each other and create kind of support systems and community infrastructure, and we keep up the pressure. So I'll kind of highlight some examples. I think with climate and community resilience, that's really paramount in crisis times. I heard Dr. Nicole Redverse, a professor at Western, speak about how between 1980 to 2021, within smoke-related evacuations, 98% of them were with Indigenous communities. So, disproportionately, this is an example of how Indigenous communities are on the front lines of the climate crisis and across Turtle Island. And, I think when we speak to climate solutions and climate policy, we, for kind of wildfires specifically, I do know that Rabble has featured kind of the On to Ottawa's demands for a national firefighting force. I think this is really interesting because they're speaking about how 70% of firefighting is volunteer-based. And, what does it look like to have this national demand to train like 50,000 firefighters? And that kind of like got me thinking with like Biden's climate announcement today in the States. They unveiled an American Climate Corps, a climate job training program for 20,000 people to work on things like improving community resilience against natural disasters. So, but that this kind of campaign did not just happen. It was because of youth activists and climate activists and community organizers like Sunrise Movement, and really pushing to make sure that like that kind of program is designed to support communities disproportionately impacted by the climate crisis. And one last thing, more locally, I guess, in Hamilton, Ontario, tenants earlier this summer successfully advocated for city council to pass a maximum temperature bylaw. And now other communities like Toronto Acorn is also campaigning like beat the heat. And that kind of thing is important as adaptation measures going forward to kind of protect tenants from heat waves when they don't have the ability to kind of install cooling measures or can't afford them. And yeah, I think, lots more we can speak to on what climate action looks like in a way that really matters to the people who need it.
No, thank you, Diana. And I must say, it is nice to see that there's some folks out there with the folks who have the privilege to do so, engaging in civil disobedience. I'll go with the name of the group, but chaining themselves to stuff like that in terms of climate action. So let's go to Leah. Leah, as we've discussed in previous Off the Hill panels, Indigenous sovereignty and climate justice are inherently linked. So as we approach the National Day of Truth and Reconciliation later this month, how does climate action from the government relate to reconciliation?
Well, as I've said before, Canada was built on the wrongful and violent dispossession of lands from Indigenous peoples. It continues today. We certainly see that on West Tsleil-Waututh territory, the use of, state police violence to impose an economic agenda that violates the rights of Indigenous people, and something that's been called out at the UN level. In fact, the level of police violence, RCMP violence that's being perpetrated against Indigenous people, and let's be honest about residential schools. It was to attempt to assimilate Indigenous people into the colonial state through violent means. And you can't separate the dispossession of lands, territories, and resources from the violent separation of our families, or even the violence against Indigenous women and girls around resource development projects, man camps, where even in the House of Commons, we facilitated a study this year to explore the relationship between the resource extractive industry and increased rates of violence against Indigenous women and girls. You know, you can't reconcile. I mean, I made a speech the other day, in fact, Monday, on my arrival back. I said, sometimes I wonder why I chose to be in this racist, misogynistic, and neo-colonial violent place, you know, the House of Commons. Sometimes I wonder. And I said, well, maybe it's to tell the truth. Maybe it's to tell these stories. And I was talking about kinship and customary care and the ongoing dispossessing of our families and children in real time, off our lands, away from our families. And our whole identity, our whole way of life is connected with our lands, our language, our culture, our livelihoods. That's why the mother is so connected to lands. And they continue to perpetrate violence against our Mother Earth. That violence continues to be perpetrated against our families. And unless we're really willing to have these real conversations in this country, the fact that we will never have climate justice if we continue to perpetrate human rights violations against Indigenous peoples, we will not reconcile in this country. So what I said on Monday is, you know, I often hear on the House of Commons, you know, discussions about reconciliation. The talk of reconciliation is cheap. And we need to move beyond that as elected officials in these spaces and have real discussions. Our Mother Earth is on the line. I'm not into doomism, but our Mother Earth is giving us a very clear message, a very clear message. And we have to respect her. And she doesn't need us. We need her. And we need to start respecting our mother. So, you know, I'll keep certainly speaking out in the House of Commons. But I think as we saw in the counter protests with this kind of extremist anti-trans movement that's happening in the country, we need a movement in this country. We need a movement in this country against rising extremism, what I called on prior to being elected, a growing corporate dictatorship. And we need to put people and our planet and all life ahead of that at this point.
No, thank you. Clayton, would you like to chime in on this one?
Yeah, I think they really, really laid it out just very eloquently and beautifully. And I think that the only thing I would add is that social movements in this country need to really understand the connection, you know, between the implementation of the 94 recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and whatever Canada, you know, implements as far as climate policy. These bodies of work and actions are inextricably linked. And this is because of the fact that colonialism caused climate change. You know, it's only been 200 years of capitalist economic systems that have almost destroyed our ability as human beings to live within the ecosystems that, you know, where Creator put us. And, you know, I think some of these important juxtapositions, like, you know, that of the need for a regenerative economic model that creates and regenerates from a place of that sacred feminine creative principle. You know, this is very critical, especially when juxtaposed against the incredible violence that's created through the extractive industries economic model that Canada is currently governed by. And, you know, as far as social movements go, you know, I think it's incredible today to see the presence of big unions, you know, showing up for our trans kids, showing up to challenge this hate. And I think that big unions and all social movement apparatuses here in Canada need to step up and escalate against business as usual when it comes to the idea of truth and reconciliation, the implementation of those 94 recommendations. And I think that reconciliation is an intergenerational, long-term, complex thing that those, you know, many of us that are alive today aren't going to see the end of that, you know. And it's not just here in Canada that this messy process is taking place. It's happening in places like South Africa and other places. But the reality of it is that we need to, at this point, especially given the existential threat of climate change, really begin to create that space for people living in so-called Canada to come together, to be learned about, you know, the truth and reconciliation process, to understand climate justice, and to make informed decisions about how to challenge the decision makers that continue to keep us on a trajectory of climate chaos and that continue to cause erasure of critical issues like Search the Landfill here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and, you know, the ongoing violence against Indigenous women and girls, and the, you know, long list of injustices that exist as a result of Canada's ongoing economic system.
Now, Clayton, I had a follow-up question for you. Part of your work involves organizing with Indigenous communities to defend their lands against the encroachment of the fossil fuel industry and the expansion of pipelines. As we know, Canada subsidizes oil and gas more than any other G20 country. Can you share how the government's funding of big oil directly influences Canada's climate emergency?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Canada averages about $14 billion in subsidies to fossil fuel. You know, this has been the number between 2018 to 2020. I think it's even higher now. You know, and big oil is getting tax breaks for carbon capture and storage, you know, a proven ineffective and grossly expensive false solution, techno fix to the climate crisis. And, you know, this won't change the fact that Canada absolutely, like everywhere else across Mother Earth, needs to phase out fossil fuels. You know, one only has to look at the debacle of the Trans Mountain pipeline and how Canada used taxpayers' money to buy that failed pipeline. You know, and the costs of that have almost tripled since they paid the initial monies for that. And Trudeau continues to mislead the entire conversation. You know, he's claiming that our emissions have trended down. However, we're lying to ourselves. Canada's on track to increase emissions over the next 10 years. And they're doing that by relying on false solutions like carbon market mechanisms and a lack of industry regulation and reporting. And based on a recent report by Oil Change International, Canada is right at the top of a list of 20 countries that are responsible for 90% of carbon dioxide pollution due to the continued funding of fossil fuel projects between now and 2050. And so the practice of ongoing government subsidies or corporate welfare, coupled with false solutions like the price on pollution and carbon pricing challenges, do absolutely nothing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the source. And so, you know, I mean, just this morning, Trudeau himself, you know, at the United Nations with, you know, had to deal with this embarrassing reality that Canada is absolutely, you know, one of the greenhouse gangsters when it comes to climate change across Mother Earth. And so I think that you know, Diane mentioned the realities of the evacuees, you know, and the incredibly disproportionate number of those during this wildfire season that have been First Nations. And, you know, part of this has been Canada's colonial legacy, decades of fire suppression, including the suppression of the practice of Indigenous controlled burns, you know, which has led to the accumulation of wildfire fuels, which has been fueling this crazy fire season. You know, we've seen more than 10, you know, more forests have burnt this year than the last 10 years combined. And, you know, there are a lot of solutions out there that we can look towards. I think the one that gets me very excited is the fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. I think folks, if you want to find information about that, check it out. And supporting Indigenous networks like the Indigenous Climate Action, who are working hard to decolonize policymaking in this country and that are supporting Indigenous nations within Canada to develop Indigenous-led climate solutions.
I gotta say, Clayton, the term greenhouse gangsta, I hadn't heard that one before. That's pretty good. And just before we go out on sugar, just one thing. In researching for this, I was looking up, I was curious to see who has the biggest oil reserves in the world. Fully thinking in my head, it's Saudi Arabia, and that's why we, you know, treat them as friends, even though they have that terrible human rights record. But it was actually Venezuela as number one, Saudi Arabia's number two, and Canada's number three, right, in terms of oil reserves, right? So that's part of the reason why they're greenhouse gases. But Chuka, let's bring you in. Bill C-226, the National Strategy on Environmental Racism and Environmental Justice Act, has been passed by the House of Commons and is currently under consideration in the Senate. So if passed by the Senate, it would require Canada to develop its first ever national strategy on environmental racism and environmental justice. So can you first define what's environmental racism, then talk about how a strategy on environmental racism and justice could help us combat future wildfire seasons?
Yeah, happily. Environmental racism refers to sort of the conditions by which certain groups, you know, people, racialized groups within society are disproportionately exposed to harm that comes from the environment they're living in. So this, examples of this are dense urban environments not having any tree shading, so they're especially susceptible to heat. There are poor conditions of housing, like mold and infestations and whatnot, which produce illness for the people living there. But they're also, on a larger scale, there is the both displacement and disruption of communities by fossil fuels.
That was a small clip from our most recent Off the Hill panel, Summer of Fire, What's Ottawa Got to Do with It? To watch the full video of our panel, please visit Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll turn it over to Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. In national news, this week saw hundreds of people across the country come together on Wednesday to push back against prejudice and hate. Unions, political leaders, teachers, parents, and others forcefully responded to the so-called 1 Million March for Children. The march promoted anti-trans and anti-2S LGBTQIA+ rhetoric under the guise of advocating for parental rights. Approximately 70 such demonstrations took place in cities across the country. But in most cases, these demonstrators were outnumbered by crowds of people promoting messages of acceptance and love. Anti-transphobia activist Faye Johnstone posted a message rallying the public to fight back against these demonstrations of hate, writing, quote, "Hate mongers think they can force us back in the closet. They think they can use fear and misinformation to roll back our rights. Here's what they don't understand. We've been through and overcame adversity they'll never understand. We aren't going backwards. We will win." End quote. In labor news, unions were at the forefront of organizing counter-protests against these 1 million march demonstrations in many communities, and they are warning the impact that these anti-trans activists could have on education. Rabble reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga reports that opposition to sexual orientation and gender identity curriculum in schools could lead to efforts to promote privatization. Laura Walton, president of the Ontario School Board Council of Unions, stated that the government could introduce a voucher system, allowing parents the option to take their children out of public school and into a private institution. Private schools can be exclusionary to certain minority groups. Furthermore, Walton explained that by removing their child from public schools, parents were allowing them to avoid important discussions, like those around gender identity. In world news, September marks the one-year anniversary of the death of Mahsa Amini, an Iranian woman who died in police custody. A year later, the civil unrest that the news of Amini's death set off in Iran and around the world still persists, as does the use of state violence in Iran. Iran is one of the world's worst in terms of use of state violence against its citizens. According to Amnesty International, over 22,000 people in Iran were arrested, tortured, or placed in solitary confinement in relation to the protests around Amini's death. Furthermore, Iran remains one of the top countries in terms of its use of capital punishment. And finally, are you a journalist at the beginning of your career with a passion for social justice? Rabble is now accepting applications for the 2023-2024 Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship. This four-month-long fellowship supports emerging Canadian journalists who are enthusiastic about social justice forward reporting. To apply, please send a cover letter indicating why you should be the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow together with your resume, feature pitch, and two writing samples to internships@rabble.ca. Your feature pitch should be a story you would like to develop during your time as a fellow and must be centered in social justice. Here's a message from Kia Lucero, our Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow from last year.
My name is Kia Lucero, and I'm the Jack Layton Journalism for Change fellow for winter of 2022 to 2023. Going through this fellowship allowed me to find out who I wanted to be as a journalist while looking introspectively at how to fulfill this role with compassion and honesty. Working on my feature piece, I was able to dive deeper into the complexities of the temporary foreign worker program. Rabble opened up the space for me to investigate the inadequacies and oppression of these systems. The Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship is for anybody who is passionate about social justice, dismantling systemic oppression, and finding solutions. I encourage anybody who is passionate about any of these things to apply.
For more details on your application and your time as a fellow, please visit rabble.ca/journalismforchange. Please note, entries close September 22nd at midnight.
Rabble.ca shares news for the rest of us. We believe news for the rest of us is about creating a more informed and connected world. Help Rabble.ca make quality, progressive news and views accessible to all. Become a Rabble Rouser today and support us during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
folks. Joey Kiss